not only for the race itself, but also for the championship, because I've got the three people that are in front of me, behind me, and a reasonable way down the list. So, I mean, this is an ideal opportunity to gap them on points.
Yeah, I was just listening to was talking about Marcus there. You still have to win races to win the day, I'm afraid, so regardless of how quick you're going. Yeah, we had a good weekend, a good day, and you know, we came away with second, which was great.
Tracks around Australia. Here's Inside Motorsport.
Hi, I'm Peter Norton.
I'm Colin Ford.
I'm Craig Revell. Thanks for joining us once again on Inside Motorsport. Joining us now is Neville Wilkinson, the editor-in-chief of V8X magazine, who's down there at Winton, where the weather held out for some pretty good racing there, Neville.
Oh, mate, sunshine today. I couldn't believe it. We started out raining, warm-up, rain. Oh, yeah. It rained all night here, and then just the clouds parted, and it was nice blue sky.
And Russ Lingle proved that he was the class of the field, starting off pole position and putting in a great run.
Well, basically, it was interesting. I mean, today it was like a bit of shenanigans in this track today. I tell you, there's a few bent cars. There was Cameron Conville rolled over and everything, but the class for today was Russell. So he had to fight for it. He didn't win the first race, and in the second race he got the start from Greg Murphy, who won the first race, and basically held Murph off for the whole race. And then, well, not really the whole race, because then Mark Scaife was up there, Jason Bright, HRT, I think they got rid of that the bogey, you know, it was supposedly Winton's their bogey track, or I think they got that off their back. But Mark Scaife and then Marcus Ambrose is up there just hassling them all day, and they couldn't get past. I mean, it's a pretty hard track to pass on. So basically, Russell just held everybody out.
Yes, and Mark Scaife, starting sort of mid-pack after a disappointing run at qualifying, all of a sudden he was up there snapping at the top couple. How did he do that? Was it the pit stops?
Yeah, well, he just... HRT are all really good with their pit stops and stuff. You know what they're like, you know. And they're going to be hard. They're always going to be up there. They're never going to be out of it. And basically, superior pit stops. And they're fast. I mean, Mark Scaife was putting in some pretty hot laps. So he came in, got their pit stop done out of the way. So he was like had clear track to really put in some fast laps. So then when everybody else did their pit stops, suddenly Mark's up there. And also there was shenanigans at the first turn on the first lap. Basically, Tony Longhurst has done the big dive trying to pass 10 cars down the inside. Just got it all over the place. He's taken out about 5 cars, including himself. And basically, that's, you know, he left the door open a little bit for Mark Scaife. So he got about 5 positions in one go there. So, I mean, it's just keep your nose clean here. Put in some fast laps. I mean, this track is a track that you've got to put down. You've got to get good power down. It's stop-start type track, you know. So if you can get your power down, which HRT obviously can, then you're looking good.
And of course, there's one guy who was caught up in that first corner incident, but then he had an amazing fight back throughout the day, including setting a new lap record, and that's Marcus Ambrose. Exciting stuff there.
Yes, absolutely fantastic. And by rights, he should have won the day. I mean, yes, he was. No one had a patch on him, I tell you. Like, he was just, He got caught up. Well, he didn't have an accident. He just had to take evasive action, and he had to go across the grass there, and people who would have watched the telecast would see that. And then he just had to fight back, and he got, I think he finished fourth in the first race. And then obviously he was there for the start, and I don't think the Stone Brothers were as quick in their pit stop as they could be, because he lost maybe one or two spots, but he was passed. I reckon he was the only driver that was really passing people, and at some stages there, he passed two cars per lap, and he was just, you know, he was exciting to watch. And it came down to the end that Russell Ingall was slow, holding up Mark Scaife, and They Marcus Ambrose is all over Mark Scaife. I tell you, Mark Scaife was sweating big time. I mean, but for 10 laps he held Ambrose, and just Ambrose could not get past him.
Yes, a remarkable drive, particularly considering it was Marcus Ambrose's first time at the track, and it was reported that he actually got lost on the way to the track.
It's a testament to how good this guy really is. And I was standing next to Howard Marsden watching the race, and he goes, "Ooh, Marcus is a bit lonely out there," because I tell you, there was like seven Holdens and Marcus, and it was just, you know, if it wasn't for Marcus, Ford would look pretty ordinary today.
Yes, that's right. Lowndes being caught up early in the first race and sat out the rest of that, and he also had an average run throughout the second race.
Oh yeah, he's just like, I mean, he started 27th, and I mean, when you're that far back, it's pretty hard to recover. You use your tyres trying to get through the field. And then you always invariably might get caught. Well, there's a good chance you're going to get caught up in someone else's accident. And or you're just trying too hard and you spear off, which what happened to Mark in the first race. He just got caught. He bobbled, basically. We went off the track here today, it was very hard to get back on. A lot of cars just went off and got bogged. It was that wet in the infield.
And another one of those Ford hopefuls was Glenn Seaton, who in the first race caught up in that first corner problem, and he was out of that race, but he had quite a good fight back in the second race coming from the back of the field.
Well, yeah, I mean, what can you say? Busted suspension from the accident, and that, you're going to look good. He had two good sets of tyres, so he could afford to burn them up in the second race, but... Yeah, I mean, Glenn's a class act, but, you know, you're pretty much against it when you start from the back.
Yes, that's right. Were there any other notable performances there that the TV cameras may have missed?
No, they got a lot of it today. I mean, I'd have to say Marcus's was the most outstanding. I mean, if that guy could have got in front, no one would have touched him. He would have just driven away from the whole field. I reckon he could have lapped everybody almost. It was that good. Big Kev? I'd have to say Paul Morris did pretty well. Qualifying was up there. There was a bit of shenanigans between Garth Tander and Jason Bright. Garth Tander was looking pretty good in the second race, then got turned around by Jason. Jason didn't get a black flag or a stop-go, so the officials deemed it as a racing incident. But, you know, there's a few people up here that felt, there was a bit of a dodgy decision, or no decision was actually made, and Brighty finished fourth.
Yes, well, thanks for that, Neville, and we look forward to more reports from V8X magazine, and of course V8X.com.au will bring you all of the news as it comes to hand as the V8s head to Bathurst in a couple of weeks.
No worries.
And joining us now is Greg Murphy, a guy who had a great race in race number one. But Greg, what happened there in race two?
Who's talking about Marcus Ambrose?
Neville Wilkinson, Peter Norton, Craig Revell and Colin Ford.
All right, okay. I was just listening to was talking about... Marcus, you still have to win races to win the day, I'm afraid, so regardless of how quick you're going. We had a good weekend, a good day, and we came away with second, which was great. Our second pit stop wasn't so fantastic, which knocked us back a bit, but consistency paid off for a change, and we didn't get caught up in all the crashing.
And how tough was the racing out there today? It looked like everyone was working pretty hard.
Mate, there was chaos out there today. I couldn't believe some of the carnage, especially 3 or 4 weeks out from Bathurst. There's some very, very badly damaged race cars. So, you've got to have some luck now and then, and a lot of it does pay off. Or sometimes it pays off, sometimes it doesn't. But today for us, it paid off, and we didn't get crashed into. So, that's what you need to do to get a result. So, no, we're very happy. The team did a good job.
Yes, you had a great run there today, and you mentioned that Bathurst is coming up. You'd be pretty happy with your preparations, I guess?
We are. I mean, we had a good run at Queensland, and we finished third, and Todd and I are looking forward to Bathurst. I think we've got a good combination, one of the better combinations out there to do a good job up there, and the cars today, Todd's car was going very good too. He just got caught up in other people's accidents, and in the race too, he got caught up with Jason Bright and Garth Tander having an incident, and that stuffed Todd's day, because his car was very fast in the second race. So, you know, we're looking forward to Bathurst. It's going to be really good.
Yes, Greg, you're definitely carrying in some good form to Bathurst, and we look forward to following your performance there.
Well, Bathurst is just the mecca of it all, and we just can't wait to get up there. It's just so much fun.
Greg Murphy, thanks for joining us.
Cheers.
Warren Dibb joins us on the line now in Procar's 10th round of the GT Performance category. Was a very interesting day, with John McAvoy taking pole position and then blitzing the two races held. Warren, better conditions for Sunday's racing, though, must have made it much more enjoyable.
Oh, you can bet on that, Craig. It started off to be a bit of an iffy day, if you might say, but then the weather did clear up. We got a nice dry line on the track. And as you say, John McElroy from pole to checkered flag in both races, also picking up a point for pole position. So a great weekend for John and the local entry for Benalla Auto Club. At the moment, Scott still leads the championship in Class C with 139 points. Alan Holgerson qualified second, finished second in both races. He's a Class D car, so he's still second in the Class D points race behind Darrell Kern, who didn't have such a successful meeting.
The racing was fairly mixed right across the board, with a lot of surprises because of the wet weather.
Well, the first corner was a bit of fun, but the problem was for everybody that Alan Holgerson was going to be thought to be holding them up. It wasn't the case, though. He managed to keep ahead of just about everybody on the straights. Darrell Kern in the first race, also in Class D, he's the current points leader. He was pursuing Alan right till the very end. In fact, he went too hard at the very end, too much brake work trying to catch up around the corners, and he had an off in the very last lap of race one, which dashed all his chances of even getting a decent place in the first race. Race two was a little bit better, though. In fact, in race two, he was having the big battle with Scott Losman, and an amazing comparison, some very even racing between the six-cylinder Falcon and the V8 Commodore, so very well matched on the track. It was the great equaliser. Rain's always said to be that, but once it dried out, it was a fair bit of racing. The surprise was down there in Class E. Martin Doxey, another local entry from Benalla, he qualified fastest for Class E, and he was leading Class E right up until the very end of the first race, and he had an off, put all four wheels off the track. He admitted it was his own mistake. That allowed the other Proton GTI of David Russell to slip through and take a win in Class E. And he also took a win in the second race, which means that David Russell has jumped to the top of the leaderboard in Class E. The main reason being Luke Yulden, who didn't compete this weekend after blowing a head gasket.
It's going to make for an interesting Sandown 500 weekend, where once again we see points races on the Saturday.
Yes, it sure will. The other good one was Brian Carr. He actually was looking like not competing at all for the second race due to a broken axle in race one, but thanks to a few friends and a bit of fast teamwork, he managed to put the car back on the track, started on the very end of the grid in race two, and finished quite well. In fact, in the second race, he managed to finish in fourth position, picking up some points, and that has still kept him in the points chase. He's running third in the championship at the moment, just behind John McElroy.
It's going to be an interesting round number 11 for the championship as we head off to Sandown. And Warren, thank you for all your help right throughout the weekend.
My pleasure, Craig. It's been fun. We've had every kind of season here, except a little bit of snow. Maybe that'll happen tonight.
Well, as we heard, the man who's jumped to the top of the leaderboard in Class E is David Russell. Congratulations.
Yeah, thanks very much.
It's been a pretty tough slog to eventually get there, and now, so close towards the end of the championship, I guess you're in the place to be.
Yeah, well, it's definitely been a hard season. Like, we've missed the first two rounds. We've been sort of chasing Luke Jordan, like, trying to get the points down. And basically, sort of, this weekend just sort of put the icing on the cake, put us in front. And with two rounds to go, we're sort of looking good. So hopefully we can wrap it up sort of in the next round and come up with another two race win.
With qualifying being on an ice skating rink and then racing today being on a cold but dry track, how much of a difference was there in the car right throughout the whole weekend?
Well, to tell you the truth, I was doing a rain dance last night because our car was just so quick in the rain. We were sort of going for, we were second outright fastest in the rain. So I was sort of looking at an outright position as well as a class win, but the dry conditions, it did feel good, but basically, yeah, we're just happy to be up in front.
Well, congratulations on that. I guess you head down to Melbourne now for Sandown and races there.
Yeah, it should be a top weekend down there too, so...
Well, we wish you all the best and congratulations on your racing right over this Winton weekend.
All right, thanks very much.
If there was any doubt on Michael Schumacher's ability, well, Spa-Francorchamps once again showed just what the greatest driver in the world can do. Jonathan Ledyard was at the circuit and he gave us this report from the BBC.
Michael Schumacher's achievement was the last thing on Alan Prost's mind on an afternoon when he almost lost a driver, as well as his Formula One record of 51 wins. On the second of three race starts, the 26-year-old Brazilian Luciano Berti was sent spearing into a tyre wall at 180 miles an hour after being clipped by his former Jaguar teammate Eddie Irvine. Irvine and track marshals worked frantically to free the car and driver as tyres collapsed on top. Remarkably, Berti suffered no broken bones, only bruising. He was helicoptered to hospital in Liège. By then, Prost had already seen his other driver, Heinz Alfredsson, relegated to the back of the grid because his car had stalled at the start. Both Williams cars were also sent from the front to the back. Montoya failed to finish and Ralf Schumacher failed to score. And all the while, his world champion brother stayed clear of trouble, leading from the fifth corner of a race, eventually reduced by 8 laps because of Berti's accident. David Coulthard cemented his championship second place, Giancarlo Fisichella claimed Benetton's first podium of the year, and John Alesi scored his first point for Jordan behind Mika Hakkinen and Rubens Barrichello. But for Barrichello, the well-being of his close friend Luciano Berti will surely have counted for more.
After the event, Michael and the top three drivers gave their drivers debriefing, and of course, Michael's starts on all three occasions were electric.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, it's unfortunate for my brother, obviously. When you say I made an amazing start, I don't think that's true. I think the guy next to me made an amazing start. I don't know which position he came from, but he almost took me. So on that side, we made average starts, and I was able to just defend my position, and thanks to whatever problem Williams had, I didn't have to fight against them because it's sort of first start. They just pull away, and I had no chance. And I think even on the second start, rather from the second position, he would have just beat me into the first corner. We didn't need to find out, and I had a clear race from that moment on, and obviously delighted.
Now, thousands and thousands of fans across the border from Köpen, your hometown, and from Germany, they kept you company during the race, but as you said, it really was, you were out on your own. How easy was it to keep your concentration and control?
I was pushing flat out until, I'd say, the second pit stop. Then I eased off. For whatever reason, I thought I had the chance to open up the gap for an extra pit stop, and we didn't know what would the weather do. So I just wanted to have that safety, and because obviously I was faster than Giancarlo and David couldn't get by, I was able to open up such a lead. That helped. I lost once the concentration going wide in turn 15. I was just playing with too many buttons at the same time and then running wide and almost gone into the barrier. It didn't need much to do that. But when you fight on the limit, when you drive, then that's what can happen.
Thank you very much, Michael. David, second place. Before you came here to Spa, would you have ever predicted you'd have spent so much of the race looking at the rear wing of a Benetton?
Absolutely not. No, Giancarlo was doing an amazing race. Obviously, his car was working better than it has done this season, and he was clicking all the right areas. So out of La Source and out of Savalo, so it was very difficult to get close. And I knew that my opportunity might come at the pit stop, and I thought I lost it when I caught one of the Minardis in Blanchimont. And I said to the team as I came down the radio, I think it's going to be close. Obviously, he came out in front of me. And then, thankfully, with the back marker at La Source, it just upset his rhythm a little bit. And I got the run through Eau Rouge, and thankfully, I was able to outbreak him. So, given the weekend I've had, then I was very happy to get second place. And, just hoping, obviously, that Luciano is 100% and able to do the next race. And then we can all feel that it's been a positive weekend.
David, looking at your car during the pit stops, it was absolutely covered with oil. Was that from your car or from someone ahead of you?
I was saying to Giancarlo that I've never been behind such a messy car. I was having to wipe my visor every single straight, and I was out of rip-offs very quickly. And I understand that it just made it across the line, so I think it was spitting all its oil out as the race went on. So it's obviously a lot quicker, but a little bit close to the limit, probably.
Thank you very much, David. Giancarlo, first time you've been in one of these conferences since Brazil last year. Can you put your finger on what has happened to your car to make it so much faster?
Obviously, there was the new aerodynamics package here, and the car was much more competitive, easier to drive, easier to make a good setup, even much more grip than normal. During the race, there was a very good balance, especially after a few laps, because at the beginning there was a lot of understeering, but then it was a good balance. We just missed a few Ks in the straight compared to the people, but maybe in Monza there is one more step on power, and we are very optimistic for the next one.
Now, you had a very unusual tyre tactic at your second stop, and you only changed the tyres at one end of the car. Can you explain why, and was it your choice?
Yeah, it was my choice. There was a problem starting with the new tyres, graining. There was a graining, and it was better to keep the same tyres. In fact, I did the race, completed the at the end of the race, I went at the end of the race with the same set of tyres, just on the front, but new on the rear. Was the right choice. We did a very good job. I did two amazing starts, especially the second one from the sixth position. I went to second, and I'm happy. It's a great day, and I would like to say thank you to the team.
Thank you very much, Giancarlo. Michael, back to you. Next race, Italian Grand Prix. You've already got the championship. It's going to be quite a party at Monza.
Yeah, you can imagine. On the other side, we still want to do well, which is going to be maybe a little bit more difficult for us, looking at the characteristics of the circuits. From Hockenheim, we know Williams is very competitive there. So we have to work very hard, and we have to find out what we can actually do against this strong package of what they have. But we certainly will try, as we have tried here. But anyway, we have good reasons to celebrate down there.
Racing at the Chicagoland Speedway was once again electric. Sam Hornish Jr. becomes the youngest ever driver to wrap up an open wheel championship. It wasn't his race though, as Lazier, this time not Buddy, but Jacques Lazier, takes the win. Here's how the Indianapolis Motor Speedway Radio Network saw the closing stages.
In his second start with Team Menard, Jacques Lazier is a winner as he takes the checkers at the Delphi Indy 300. Sam Hornish Jr. has clinched the 2001 Indy Racing Northern Light Series Championship with a second place finish, and Eddie Cheever is on the podium third, Jeff Ward fourth, and Donnie Beechler fifth. What a run for 30-year-old Jacques Lazier, and he has made a statement as only his second start with Team Menard as he takes the checkered flag today at Chicagoland Speedway.
Well, Mike King, what another fantastic sellout weekend it was at Chicagoland.
Jacques Lazier, the winner today here at Chicagoland Speedway.
Hard times throughout our career, and everything's paid off. I'm here with Team Menard and Johns Manville. I'll tell you, I just can't be prouder. This is the greatest day of my life. The only hiccup we had is when we had a slight piston failure. Other than that, it's just been absolutely just perfect.
Sam Hornish Jr. was second.
Pendle Panther team, man, they've been great all year long. In the pits, gave me flawless cars every time we went out there, and we may not always been the fastest, but we were always finishing up towards the front. It was an awesome race. Everybody out there, the Indy Racing League proved once again that it's probably got about the best show out there.
Eddie Cheever was third.
The last two times we came in for the pit stops, we had an electronic problem, and the engine kept stalling, and we come in third, and we come out 15th. It was just diabolically bad, just horrible. They started off bad, breaking an engine this morning, and I had the best car, and it's just a sin to finish third with an engine like that.
Jeff Ward wound up fourth.
Track is just circumstances during the race. I mean, we just hung in there, and, you know, we didn't have the fastest car by any means. We were just... I hooked up with Eddie there at the end, who had a really quick car and just pulled me up to the front there and just hung in all day. The team did a great job. We got hit in the pits coming in and hit me sideways, and, you know, luckily we didn't break anything, so it was kind of hard going back out there hoping nothing was, you know, wrong with the car. But, you know, the team did a great job, and Menard Motor ran great, so we're happy to be up in the top five.
Donnie Beechler was fifth. Richie Hearn was sixth, one lap down. Laurent Rodon, a good outing in his first appearance with Conquest Racing. That team will be coming on full-time with the league next season. He drives once again for Eric Bachelard. Alan Sir Jr. followed up his win last week at Gateway with an eighth-place finish here today. Buzz Calkins ninth. Felipe Giafone winds up 10th after the blown engine late.
So we had a great week, and, you know, the team did a great job, and I had an awesome car during the whole day, but in front, I mean, these type of things we really can't control, you know, and we'll see. I think we're ready to go to Texas now.
Buddy Lazier was 11th, Billy Boat finished 12th, Didier Andre 13th, Rich Treadway 14th, and John Herb finished 15th. Chris Meninga was 16th, and Mark Dismore 17th. Eliseo Salazar 18th, Ayrton Dare 19th, Robbie McGee 20th, Shige Hattori 21st, Robbie Buell 22nd, Billy Rowe 23rd, Sarah Fisher 24th, and Scott Sharp 25th. For you points-wise, Sam Hornish Jr. will go to Texas with an insurmountable 66-point lead over Buddy Lazier. Scott Sharp shown in third place, but still, Johnny Parsons, there is a good battle between Scott Sharp and Billy Boat for that third spot in points. In fact, you now have three teams that will be fighting it out for third because Scott Sharp, with the Kelly Racing Team with 315 points, finds himself 20 points ahead of Billy Boat from that Kerr Agajanian Beck Motorsports team and 20 points in front of that Treadway Hubbard team that fields the car for Felipe Giafone. So we've still got some good championship battles.
Oh, yeah,
to talk
those
about.
Battles mean equate to big money at
That's
the end
right.
of the year at the banquet.
Yeah, so but Sam Hornish Jr. is the champion as we see him crowned here today. He will he'll be officially crowned, as we said, in 2 weeks at Texas Motor Speedway. We had seven straight lead changes at one point between Jacques Lazier and Felipe Giafone, starting with lap number 100, and it winds up today with Lazier winning. A total of 14 lead changes among five different cars. It was the 2 car of Jacques Lazier, the 4 car of Sam Hornish Jr., the 21 machine of Felipe Giafone, the 24 of Robbie Buell, and the 28 of Mark Dismore that were shown as leaders today. 3 yellows during this 200-lap event today, covering 26 laps. Those 3 yellows, 1 for debris, 1 for a single car incident with Scott Sharp making contact with the outside wall. That was on lap 30, and the 1 for debris on lap 123, and then on lap 163, the final caution of the day for Eliseo Salazar and Mark Dismore getting together in turn number 3, a 2-car incident. We are happy to report that those drivers all walked away uninjured.
The Molson Indy was run last weekend. Here's Jim Murphy and the Honda Champ Car Update.
Welcome to the Honda Champ Car Update. I'm Jim Murphy. Join me now as we make a visit to the fast-paced world of the kart series. Molson Indy Vancouver started off looking like it was going to be a Canadian's dream weekend, but it turned out to be a carbon dust-filled crash fest. While Alex Tagliani and his player's teammate Patrick Carpentier started on an all-Canadian front row, it was Roberto Moreno alternately charging and dodging his way to victory lane for his second career kart win. During qualifying, Alex Tagliani made the most of his time in his home country by leading the way during Friday's test session as well as capturing his second career pole on Saturday.
Yeah, I'm very pleased because the players' team is working really hard, and you know, we have the support of the crew and the engineers, and when we're on track, we're trying our best, but the best way to thank my guys is to give them a good result like this in Canada.
At the start, Tagliani was checking out with Carpentier slotted in behind. However, Tagliani's transmission failed as he approached his second pit stop of the day, ending his run. Carpentier briefly inherited the lead before pitting himself when he got caught out by the yellow flag when it flew for an accident involving Max Pappas shortly after he rolled to a stop in his pit box. By the time the field got sorted out, Gilles Deferrin was leading Moreno and Michael Andretti. Carpentier eventually ended his day in Turn 1's runoff area after getting drilled in the back by Kenny Brack on a restart. Moreno moved past Deferrin with a handful of laps remaining and drove to a very emotional victory lane.
Thank you. I'm just sorry that my darlings are not here. See, Andreas and Chiara, but I'm sure they've been watching on TV, and it's just a lot of enjoyment. I've got to thank you, the Vision team, big time. They gave me a good car. They gave me a good situation. And they trusted me. That's the most important.
Deferrin diced with Moreno all day long, swapping places 3 times. However, the final time came after an uncommon Deferrin error.
It was a very exciting race. Very exciting race for us. And you know, it was fun dicing out there. And I managed to get by Moreno on that last restart. And was leading, but unfortunately I made a small mistake. bounced off the inside wall and lost the lead.
Michael Andretti, always strong in Canada, showed up on the podium once again, finishing third.
Yeah, I'll take it. You know, it was a good run. We were able to get some more points. Stayed out of trouble. It was, you know, a race of patience today.
Here's how they finished at the Molson Indy Vancouver. It was Roberto Moreno over Gilles Deferrin and Michael Andretti. Tony Kanaan and Oriol Servia round out the top five. Michelle Jourdain Jr., Toru Takagi, Kenny Breck, Dario Franchitti, and Memo Gidley round out the first 10. 11 through 15, Christian Fittipaldi, Bruno Junqueira, Scott Dixon, Shinji Nakano, and Maurizio Guzman. 16th through 20th, Patrick Carpentier, Brian Herta, Elio Castroneves, Jimmy Vassar, and Cristiano D'Amata. 21 through 25, Adrian Fernandez, Max Pappas, Alex Tagliani, Alex Zanardi, and Max Wilson. Rounding out the 26-car field, Paul Tracy. The time of the race, 2 hours, 10 minutes, 1.276 seconds, for an average speed of 80.543 miles an hour. The margin of victory, 4.687 seconds. On the strength of his second-place finish, Gilles Deferrin takes over the car championship points lead for the first time this season. Deferrin, who has not won a race yet this year, has 115 points, followed by Kenny Breck and Helio Castroneves, each with 110. Michael Andretti is now fourth with 103. Next up, the FedEx Championship Series heads to the Euro Speedway in Lausitz, Germany in 2 weeks.
Each week, the Honda Champ Car Update brings you the latest news from the world of karts, straight from the track and directly from the driver's mouth. This experience is brought to you by the folks at Honda. Racing is part of who Honda is, and you can see that by visiting www.hondaracing.com.
John Davison, of course, always a pleasure to have him on the show. Here's part two of an interview that we started last week. And, of course, this time we focus in on Evesco. He has the V8 race at the end of the season and how his dealings have been with Evesco since they announced that they were going to try and put a media day on during his Sandown 500 and after they stole the Sandown 500 from him only 3 years ago.
Firstly, I don't have anything to do with Evesco. In matter of fact, I don't even have a contract with Evesco to run the V8 event. I have a contract with IMG. It's IMG that have the contract with Evesco. And quite frankly, it suits me fine not to have to deal with them, more particularly Cochrane. They were the ones that tried to mount the media day against us. And frankly, it didn't flatter me at all. Didn't worry me at all. Because the last 8 months, Tony Cochrane has done nothing else but criticise Bathurst. So how in the hell can he then run a media day to attract the media to go back there if he'd spent so much time criticising the place? Secondly, the media are not interested in going up to Bathurst for that sort of thing when really they can see it in any one of the normal touring car rounds. So I wouldn't say I was strained. It was purely and simply that, oh, well, if that's what they want to do, let them go. It really didn't faze me at all because in the end run, the Sandown 500 will always be greater than a media day for another event.
Mm. The other thing that I know has been a constant source of ire to you is street races, and I think Tony once again is the man we have to lance a barb at, saying, no, the Perth government didn't want to pay for me to come and put a race on for them, so we're not going to go back there.
Well, that's Tony Cochrane. Whether or not it's the feeling of the board of Evesco and the naming and the sponsors, particularly people like Shell and Mobil that are national companies, would be interesting to find out. I mean, you'd have to turn around and say that Adelaide Street Race has been a fantastic burn. It really has done a lot for touring car racing in this country. Whether or not you'd say the street race at Canberra has done the same thing, I'll leave each person to decide for himself. My only regret with street circuits is there's no ongoing permanency for motorsport, that there's an enormous amount of government money spent in underwriting these events, where the circuit is ready to go on a Wednesday and pulled apart on a Monday, and that to me is rather wasteful. In any country you're going to get it happening on an occasional basis, but in Australia it nearly happens on every state basis. And I suppose now that they've run a couple of street races, over the last 3 or 4 years, that other governments that are being approached to do the same thing have now got some means by which they can evaluate them. And I would say that that's pretty much been the case with the Western Australian government, that they now have facts and figures that they can go to the Canberra Tourism Events Corporation, or they can glean and observe for themselves. But like most state tourism bodies, when it comes to events running through the streets that are going to involve a very considerable number of millions in capital works programs, they really have to be sure that these events are going to get international exposure. And whether or not Avesco decide to go back to Western Australia or not, I suppose, is entirely up to them. But in defence of the Western Australian Sporting Car Club and the Barbagallo track, they have tried to do everything to accommodate the V8s. And with respect to Cochrane, the Western Australian government did put some money up this year in terms of improving the sanctioning fee that Avesco went there. So if it was me, I would be very careful lambasting governments. They tend to have long memories.
Of course, we talked about you and your Channel 10 involvement originally getting them to go into motor racing, and that was their first serious foray into the form. We've now seen them take over. But in 1996, when we spoke on Inside Motorsport, I was under the impression that you had just signed a three or five year television contract. And I know when the race was hoodwinked up to Queensland, you still had an existing television contract with Channel 10.
Well, yeah, that is correct. But one of the things, one of the conditions of the contract is that I had to be able to guarantee the cars in order for the contract to be afoot.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that's what Avesco did, is we're not going to turn up. So, as Channel 10 said, and this I've learned from experience now, at the time I remember John McAlpine, who's now the CEO, saying to me, well, John, of course, the contract's dependent upon you getting the cars. And I sort of just, oh, well, yeah, of course, John, that would be fair enough, never dreaming that all the work and effort and blood, sweat and tears that I put into it, that I'd lose it. But just goes to show what happened. So I'd have to be perfectly honest with you, Craig. Look, I am very, very sceptical today of how much loyalty pays.
But
that is not a comment from a cynical individual. It's just I've seen so many instances in car racing where a lot of hard work and tenacity, and as soon as it suits somebody else, they do the opposite.
Oh, I was just wondering to that end, does that contract stand up now that you have got the cars and the race is going ahead? Can you go back to 10 and say, hey, this contract's still got a year to run, we've got the cars on the track?
Well, theoretically, no. I think that there was... no, look, I wouldn't bother taking it on. You'd be running up a dry gulch in endeavouring to run that argument. It wouldn't be worthwhile. It wouldn't achieve anything except create a lot of aggravation that I don't think would be of any useful advantage to me.
So basically what we're saying is if you want to see the Sandown 500, you have to get to the track.
Yes, well, there won't be any live coverage of the Sandown 500. There will be a delayed coverage a week later. And you have to bear in mind, it's only been about the last 6 or 7 years that the 500 was ever televised live. Back in the days when Moffat and Brock were running, and John Gosson, when they were allegedly getting 40 and 50,000 people to the venue, it was televised on the ABC, but there was a blackout in the City of Origin. That is, there was no television coverage in Melbourne, or for 160 kilometres, and the four points of the compass. And the only coverage that Melbourne got was 11 o'clock at night. Now, I'm not sure whether or not live television coverage affects the crowd or not. It's a pretty hard argument. If you look at the Australian tennis, for example, the Grand Slam event at the National Tennis Centre, they get extraordinary crowds, yet Channel 7's coverage of it has been massive. So you could probably argue, and the Melbourne Cup would be the same too, I would think, and maybe the Grand Prix, that live television coverage does not affect the crowds. But it does, in my opinion, if the weather's marginal.
I know in the United States, the Thunder program on ESPN, when I spoke to the producers of that, they said, in actual fact, when they were running that on a Thursday night, the crowd started off very small, as you expect Thursday night race meeting too. And what happened was, people were seeing it on the TV, and America being as it is, people were then driving from, you know, other states to go to the race because they were seeing it on TV. And they said television actually brought more people to the venue.
Yes, well, I think that motorsport is fortunate. And this was certainly... What I said to Channel 10 when I first sat down with John McAlpine was, John, there is an enormous number of companies within the automotive industry. It's not just the obvious like Shell and Mobil and Bridgestone and Goodyear and Ford and General Motors. There's a whole lot of boutique companies like Repco and Autobahn and Wins and Pettis shock absorbers and all sorts of things like Hella Lights and things like this that have got advertising budgets that really have not found a home to do this. And, of course, they being a commercial network immediately thought about this. And I went to a lot of trouble to go through the Automotive Digest, if you could call it that, or the Victorian Automobile Chamber of Commerce yearbook, and I produced them a four A4 pages of potential advertisers on their telecasts. And when you have that commercial perspective about what you're doing, and you put on an event of excellence, and you get treated the way I've been treated, you can understand that I am very determined to make the Sandown 500 work. And even though Ross Palmer is underwriting the event, I am putting as much effort into attention to detail this event as if it was my own. And I'm not interested in what anybody says what the crowd should or can't be. The event will work. The V8 brutes, the utes will get quicker, and there'll be a lot more of them. And there will be a much greater number of V8 supercar drivers that want to get rides in this event. It's made me very determined what has happened to me in the last 3 or 4 years.
Well, I know the drivers just can't wait to get to Sandown. They realise that Sandown was always considered one of the great races, and now they're just saying, well, we never thought we'd have an opportunity. Someone like Darcy Russell on Melbourneite, he realised he never had an opportunity to win a Sandown 500 with the way it was going, and now all of a sudden, landing on his plate, he has now got a front-running car that can be, an outright contender.
Yeah, well, good on him, and he's been prepared to make the investment in that 8-litre car, and they're pretty spectacular, and I wish Darcy well. It'll be interesting to see who he gets. I've suggested to Ross Palmer that the event next year had been an international event, because there are things that you have to do with the FIA, the world governing body, around about this time of the year, actually, in June and July, apply for the international status of the event. And I mean, Ross Palmer has been over to the Nürburgring and Spa and done those long-distance races for production-style cars. And they are huge.
Mm-hmm.
They are huge. And when you look at Mitsubishi or Nissan or BMW or a myriad of other importers like Chrysler, they don't have anywhere that they can race in Australia except in production car racing. So I think that that beckons well for all.
Well, for people who want to get more information on the Sandown 500 and the Sandown International Raceway, your website is at www.sandownraceway.com.au, and of course all the information, the history of the preceding 33 Sandown 500s is also there on the site to check out, and we'll be just very interested to see who is the newest winner of this great race in Australian motorsporting and certainly in Australian motorsport.
Righto, Craig. Well, I thank you for your support, and we are in fact upgrading our website. We hope to have all the latest information on it with some musical scores and so on by the end of next week. But if they want to ring, they can ring us on Melbourne 9853 7266, and I'd like to thank you on behalf of Procar today and Inside Motorsport for being a guest on your program yet again.
This week, Brendan Ramsey joins us on the line to talk Formula Holden, and what an interesting run it was. Congratulations, third place in race number one.
Yeah, thanks, Craig. We did have plenty of action here today for the Formula Holdens. It was a class field, actually, all the way. We had 14 cars taken to the track, and as you say, in race one, I ended up with the third, but Rick Kelly went away with the win in race one from Paul Stokel, who was driving in the second Barana car and making a return to Formula Holden during this last round. So Rick Kelly from Paul Stokel and then myself in third put a Barana 1-2-3 in race one, which was something we've never done before. So the boys were pretty happy with that.
Mm.
And behind third position was Murchison in fourth, Gurr, and then Peter Hill, Emerson Newton-John, Clear a Hand from Canberra, Asai, Peters and Tim Lay rounded out the 11 finishes. So there was plenty of action in race one, and it was good to see the Formula Holdens going head-to-head at Winton.
Yeah, interesting to see that Greg Murphy Motorsports had two runners in there, one with Peter Hill and the other one running out there was Tim Lay.
Yeah, that's right. Tim is another driver who returned to Formula Holden for this last round, and he was doing a pretty good job in that car that's had only minimal development with Murphy Motorsport. It's a Raynard 94D, and he's having a good scrap. He actually did quite well in the second race and ended up coming up fourth in race two, so he worked his way up as the weekend went on. This one was pretty treacherous. It was just had a little shower of rain at the start of the race, and the drivers were really sort of just feeling out the track on the first few laps. It was quite slippery. But then by the end of the race, the track had dried and everybody was able to get down to some serious time. So, it was good to see a number of drivers entering. Another driver who also entered from Japan was Akihiro Asai, running the third Hocking Motorsport car. So when you look at it, we had Stokel returning with Barana. We had Emerson Newton-John from America, Aki Asai from Japan, and Tim Lay also coming in with Murphy Motorsport. So it was a very strong field.
Yeah, and a New Zealander in there, that's probably the only one you're missing. Murchison's from Singapore.
Yes, that's right. We were planning to have James Cressy from New Zealand, but that negotiations there didn't quite come to fruition, so it was Chris Starr who ended up going in with a second car. So, we had plenty of experience there. And actually, just as a point of trivia, I think we had the greatest number of race wins in a Formula Holden field ever, because you look down the field, Kelly obviously has got a race win, Stokel's had race wins, Chris Staff has had a race win, Tim Lay had race wins. So, there was great class throughout the field.
Yeah. Now, in race number two, it's a man who's looking to put his Lamborghini in the winner's circle next weekend, Paul Stokel, who took the victory.
Yeah, well, there was high drama in race two, because what happened is off the line we had Akihiro Asai and Canberra's Terry Clearahan coming together, and Asai's car was actually launched up into the air, and I've seen an amazing photograph of Aki's car that looks like it's about half a metre off the air. It's quite incredible, and unfortunately they've both speared off into the wall, and Terry Clearahan's had a very hard impact with the wall there. And the medical crews attended to him for quite some time in the car. His head was to the side. It looked like he'd been knocked out. But he recovered from that, and there was no serious problem. Saw him later on after the race walking around talking on his phone. So it's fine, thank goodness for that. But that caused a red flag on turn one, race two, and we went to the lights again for the restart. Stokel jumped away, and Kelly was pursuing and ended up just pushing that a little bit too hard, and we saw Rick have a big lose and drop back. I think he dropped back pretty much to last, and then mounted a huge charge through the field to work his way all the way up. He just got past me before he decided to have another lose, and in fact we both went off. I had nowhere to go, so it wasn't the best run for Rick and myself in race two, but Rick managed to get back up to fifth position, so that was a good result for him. But when you look at race two, it was Stokel who took the win. Alan Gurr, who actually did a pretty good drive, considering he had that he had a shunt yesterday that left him feeling a little bit sore. So Alan, a great result for the teenager there in second. And Emerson Newton-John did a great job for Hocking Motorsport, coming through for third, and that's a good result for Emerson. Tim Lay came fourth. Rick recovered from those spins to come fifth, and actually set the fastest lap of the race. And then Peter Hill and myself, Roger Oakeshott and Ian Peters. And also just looking at the Silver Star runners there, going into the last race, it was between Peters and Clearahan as to who was going to win the Silver Star. But obviously when Terry went out on that turn one incident, that left Peters with the Silver Star. So Peters, a good win for him in the Silver Star award. And yeah, it was an excellent result considering he's finished every race, and was very keen to win that award. There's plenty of action in race two and plenty of drama. Definitely watch out for that on trackside if you get the chance.
Now, it would also mean that Christian Murchison has wrapped up second position. Kelly, of course, wrapping up the Gold Star Championship last round. And Alan Gurr and Peter Hill still having a reasonable battle for third place outright.
Yeah, that's right. If we look at the championship points now that the season has come to an end, because that was our last round today, Rick Kelly obviously takes a strong win on 293, and then Murchison, 142 points, takes second. That's a good result for the Singaporean driver. And then Alan Gurr with 130 points in third, and Peter Hill in fourth. So Emerson Newton-John coming in fifth in the top five. So that was the way the 2001 Holden Australian Drivers' Championship panned out. And in the Silver Star, it was Ian Peters, as I mentioned, from Terry Clearahan. And Roger Oakeshott came in third there, so a good result for the Doc, who come in third in the Silver Star.
And congratulations to Brenton Ramsey. Thanks for all your help right throughout what has been another exciting Formula Holden season.
Yeah, my pleasure. I think we've definitely finished on a strong note here, an excellent lineup of drivers and cars and plenty of action and a lot of strength at the front of the field, which is what we like to see. And to see these cars going head-to-head, that's what we really are excited about in Formula Holden. And there's plenty of plans going on at the moment about Formula Holden and the way it's going to take shape next year, and that's all very exciting. So, yeah, we're looking forward to those things coming out in the future and keeping you up to date on that.
Yes, Brenton Ramsey, right throughout the year, thanks very much for your help here on Inside Motorsport. Paul Sokol joins us on the line now, and as you heard from Brenton Ramsey, a win in race number two of the Formula Holdens was a good way to keep the old hand and feet coordination in for the Sandown 500 next weekend.
Thanks. It was a good result. I enjoyed it immensely.
It's an interesting step, isn't it, from a closed sedan to a open wheel car?
Yeah, it is. I think, everyone asks me why I've done this, and it's really just, I just felt like I needed sharpening up, and, you know, there's no better way of doing it in a car that responds to what you want it to do, and it stops and it turns, and, you know, it's a real race car. Everything else on the track's a compromise, you know, the Lamborghini and the V8s and all those sorts of things. So, I was keen to get back in, and as it turned out, I haven't lost my touch.
Rick Kelly is a fairly young fella, and certainly has a lot of skill.
Yeah, Rick's quick, there's no doubt about that. I mean, the guys at Barana have been around long enough now, they know, you know, they've had myself, they've had Simon Wills, and, you know, Rick Kelly is, taking the championship out, and they know a good driver, and they said, you know, Rick is definitely one of the quicker drivers I've had, so, you know, I feel fairly happy that I've been able to keep pace with him at such a short time, and, you know, I guess it's proven in my mind that I've sort of still got what it takes.
Now, of course, you're going to make sure you use those skills next weekend with the Sandown 500, of course, on Saturday, a regular round of the Pro Car Championship Nations Cup, and then, of course, the big one on Sunday afternoon.
Yeah, we've got Stephen Johnson co-driving with me, and he has had a run in the car, and he's had a lot of laps, but he's certainly been consistent, and, you know, I'm looking forward to it. The most important races, really, for me, is the championship race on Saturday. And the 500 on Sunday, well, if we can do well, I mean, it's a bit of luck, I guess, when it comes to reliability and slower traffic and all that sort of thing, but I'd be very happy if we could take that one out, and I'm sure Stephen would too.
And, of course, for yourself, this race is now going to be a crowning jewel in the Nations Cup calendar, and then soon after that, you have to go off to Malaysia.
Yeah, I guess this is the big one that, you know, John Davison down at Sandown's pinned a lot of hopes on the revival of the Sandown 500 and using Nations Cup cars as a draw card. And Malaysia soon after, I'm not 100% sure what's happening there. There was some rumours that negotiations had sort of fallen down a little bit, but we're still hopeful of going, and it'd be certainly a big experience to race on the Sepang circuit over there. I'd love to have the chance to do it.
Well, congratulations on your run today, and all the best for next week's Sandown 500 and, of course, the Pro Car rounds for the Nations Cup held on the Saturday.
Yeah, thanks very much. We'll certainly be giving it a best shot.
Brett Ramsey joins us on the line now, of course, the host of In Pit Lane, which has been an extremely successful television program on Channel 31 down there in Melbourne. Now, I know with community television starting up in Canberra, we're looking forward to an opportunity here, hopefully, to see some local motorsport also broadcast on TV. But for yourself, it has been an ongoing battle to keep In Pit Lane on the air.
Well, yes, it has been, Craig, over the past 6 years. We started off on cable TV down here on Optus Vision before we moved on to community television, which was a big surprise to a lot of people. But when you look at the figures, the number of people watching community television down here compared with the number of subscribers to something like Optus Vision, which we used to be on, it was actually a very good move. We've... according to the latest surveys, we've got around sort of 77,000 average viewers a week, which is a pretty healthy sort of figure. And the show's been going very well in the main in terms of our support for from the local motorsport community.
Of course, we here in radio have got probably at 1/10, maybe even 1/100 of the costs that are involved in putting on a program devoted to motorsport, and that is normally your ongoing battle, trying to get the funding together to put the shows on.
Well, that's it, as you say. I mean, I'm a great fan of radio. Besides having a really good head for radio, there's a lot of great advantages. I mean, we've probably got about, you know, every Tuesday night we go to air live right across Melbourne. We're looking at around, sort of, I think there's around 25 people involved in putting the program to air. There's sets to be built. There's tape to, you know, broadcast tape, which has to be bought. A lot of travelling, a lot of editing. Yes, it can get very expensive. In real terms, we're looking at probably around $6,000 to $8,000 a week in just to get the program on the air. So we need support. If we're going to continue into next year, we certainly need support from the local motorsport community. But at the moment, things are looking very good for that because this year, as I said, the show has become very, very successful. We're getting a really good response from our viewers, getting lots of competition entries for our various competitions that we have down here. And things are looking pretty good, I think, for next year.
And, of course, Brett, this Tuesday night marks the final program in this season, but it's also a very special one with the Clarion Sandown 500 being run this weekend. It's a timely opportunity to, show a real jewel in the Melbourne Motorsport Crown.
Yes, it's very important. I mean, we actually managed to convince Channel 31 to extend our season by a few weeks in order that we could get this show on, because we really wanted to give this thing a plug. I mean, it's important for a number of reasons. One is the return of the Sandown 500. It's a traditional race in Melbourne, the Sandown Enduro. It goes back, you know, many years back into the mid-60s. But also in terms of in keeping a track like Sandown open, which is a very, very valuable resource down here, we need something more than just the once-a-year sort of a Vesco circus rocking into town and dazzling us with its wonderment and then disappearing at the end of the year. We need other races on, we need other categories, we need variety, and for that reason we're really hopeful that next week at Sandown is going to be a very big meeting. And it's also very interesting the fact that there's so many variables there. I mean, you know, what is going to win? Is it going to be the power of the Lamborghini or the Dodge Viper, or we're looking at the reliability of Ferrari or Porsche? If it's wet, who knows? I mean, an Evo 5 or an Evo 6 or a Subaru could come up and win at the end of 500 Ks. Lots of unknowns there, so it's pretty exciting.
And it's also a change back to what the Sandown 500 really originally was, which was a production car race.
That's right, you know, multi-manufacturer, multi-class, and the cars do have some relevance to people on Monday. You can have a look right across the category and you see things like the battle between in the six-cylinder class between the XR6s and the SS six-cylinder Commodores, the Camry, the Magnas. That's basically where most people are buying their cars. So, and I think a lot of people have been really surprised at the performance of things like the Magna and the Camry. They're very competitive on the track against those much hyped sort of high performance sixes from Ford and Holden. Hello, yes, yeah. You just dropped out for a second,
so,
Greg.
I was just this Tuesday night at 9:30. Of course, the final of In Pit Lane for the series, and of course the Sandown preview. I know you do have a lot of great guests coming on.
Yes, we've got Darcy Russell, who's the driver of that big Dodge Viper, and certainly if it stays dry and if it can last, that'll be well suited to Sandown. We've also got Graham Alexander, who drives the Mitsubishi, the Lancer Evo 5, Rod Wilson from the V8 Brutes. This is the debut of the V8 Utes in Melbourne, so a lot of people will be interested in having a look at the Utes, and also the the promoter of Sandown Raceway, John Davison. And John's sort of been a semi-regular on the show for years, and he's always got something to say. He's a very forthright individual. He gives good guests, as we say, and we're always pleased to see John on. He always has, you know, plenty of quotable quotes, so John will be on as well. Plus, we've got a couple of surprises. We're drawing our prize. We're giving away a hyperstimulator down here, and we've had thousands of entries for that, and we've got a bit of a surprise, we hope, for someone there with the drawing of that next Tuesday night at 9:30.
All right, Brett, it's been a pleasure to catch up with you, and of course anyone down there in Melbourne, 9:30 Tuesday night for In Pit Lane, and we certainly wish you all the best for, of course, finding that funding for a new season coming up in 2002.
Okay, thanks a lot, Craig.
Yes, it's great to see another community-based program out there, and all the best to our friends in the TV world.
Well, let's move offshore for a moment, and there's a lot of motor racing taking place overseas this weekend. First of all, we go to Austria and the A1 Ring, where they're having the latest round of the German DTM. And once again, it's Bernd Schneider for the Mercedes team who's taken pole position for the races, which will be later today, their time, our time. And behind him, there's Peter Dumbrick and Uwe Alzen, also Mercedes, with Lawrence Aiello sitting fourth on the grid in the first of the Audis with his teammate Martin Tomaszek. Then we've got Bird Mainlander in another of the Mercedes Benzes, and then Alain Menu is top of the Opals. So things should be interesting racing there. I'm wondering, it's one of those fairly fast circuits, and the interesting part here is, of course, Audi and Opel getting much more up in the field than they were previously. As well, this weekend, the British Touring Car Championship is racing at Silverstone, and it's bad boy Phil Bennett, who missed the last round at Alton Park through suspension. He's taken advantage of his lack of success ballast by grabbing pole position for both of today's races in the British Touring Car Championship. So a time when getting suspended does pay off. You don't have to carry the extra weight. You can go quicker, therefore you qualify on pole, and it's up to everybody to get past you. So looking good for him. He's got sitting behind him on the grid Ivan Muller and Jason Plato in the two Vauxhall Astra Coupes from the factory team. Then, interestingly enough, Steve Soper in the Peugeot 406 Coupe sitting in fourth ahead of James Thompson. Then Anthony Reid in the first outing for the new MGZS. He's sitting sixth on the grid. Thomas Erdos in the Lexus 7. And then Warren Hughes in the second of the MGs 8th. The two Alfa Romeos of Tim Harvey and Mark Blair, they're sitting 10th and 11th. This weekend as well, they've got the European Touring Car Championship at the Nürburgring. And there, Gabriele Tarquini will start from pole position. From Nicola Arini in the Alfa Romeo, Tarquini in the Jas Engineering Honda Accord. And sitting third on the grid there is Matt Neal in the privately run Nissan Primera. Obviously the bit of racing he's been down here has sharpened up his skills, sitting there third above them. As well at Nürburgring this weekend, the FIA GT Championship, and it's Rickard Riedel and Peter Cox is sitting on pole there. And they in the ProDrive All-Stars Ferrari 550. And they're ahead of Blikmolen and Blikmolen in the Viper, and Blikmolen and Hesemans in another Viper. And as well, Laguna Seca this weekend for the American Le Mans Series, and it's Audi's back to their usual winning or qualifying ways. Tom Christensen and Ronaldo Capello, they're on pole from Stefan Johansson and Patrick Lemaire. That's actually in the champion golf-backed car. Then Frank Bieler, Manuel Pirro, and Pirro in another Audi, so it's Audi 1-2-3 at Laguna Seca. Then David Brabham and Jan Magnussen in first at the Pinozas in fourth. Klaus Graf and Frank Lagorch in another Pinoz in fifth. And the top of the GTS is Terry Bocella down in 13th in the Saline. And the GTs, it's Leighton Muller in the BMW M3 GTR. Of course, with them, they are actually now fighting a new air restrictor size that's been put on them to sort of slow them down, but they're still doing fast enough to go and get themselves the class pole.
And something I'd welcome your thoughts on, Colin, is the state of the Jaguar Formula One team. Being a keen observer of Ford, and in particular their share price over the last couple of months, the Ford share price, the company has lost 25% of its value in just the last couple of months. So I think the big guys at Ford must be starting to worry about where they're spending their pennies, and Jaguar would be one. And I'm sure the Australian Motorsport Program will come under scrutiny as well. And also, Niki Lauda, who, of course, is now at the helm of the Jaguar team, how do you think that's going to impact their performances on track, particularly with some of their internal bickering?
I'd say that's going to do something nasty to them. Realistically, I think that what we're going to probably find is that it'll fragment and fracture, and it'll explode and implode, and somebody else is going to have to come in and clean up the mess.
Yes, because as it is already, Niki Lauda has gone public with some of his criticism of the number one driver, of course, good old Eddie. What the rat is saying is that Eddie can be very abrasive with his colleagues, and that's far more important failing than his addiction to sharing opinions with the press, especially in the kind of stressful situation that Jaguar in at the moment. That's the quote that's being reported at the moment. And Lauder goes on to say, yes, it is important to be critical, but it needs to be done in a constructive way. So I can really imagine that Jaguar is not a friendly, happy place to be working at the moment.
Well, I think you might want to close your ears off for a second, because I'm about to give you the NASCAR results from Richmond, and it was Kevin Harvick who looked like he was going to muscle his way through to take another victory. In fact, it wasn't, and Ricky Rudd pulled a punch back for the older veteran drivers, bumped Harvick back out of the way after he in turn had been bumped out of the way with 17 laps to go, and has gone through for a victory at Richmond International Raceway. And of course, that improves his position on Jeff Gordon, who is the series points leader, as they come out of Richmond now and into the downhill run towards the series championship. Now, a word before we go into our last series of interviews, just to say that next week Inside Motorsport will be at the special time of 5 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. next Sunday, because we do have the ACTAFL Grand Final on straight in our normal regular time slot. So ACTAFL fans and AFL fans, be aware, your Centre Bounce program will be starting earlier next week, and of course Inside Motorsport fans, because of that, we will be moving to the 5 o'clock time slot.
Well, just in terms of heading back to the American Le Mans Series, it looks like Nissan is eyeing a return to national sports car racing after an absence of 2 years with the latest in its line of high-performance Z cars. I must admit, I saw a photograph of what this car looks like, and it looks surprising like an Audi TT or a Porsche GT3. It's that same sort of look, but anyhow, it looks like Nissan's coming back in. Nissan is now back in the black, having been taken over by Renault, and they're looking to get back into motorsport, so that would be fun and games. And of course, I wonder if that means we might see a Nissan name on a Formula One car with a Renault engine, in inverted commas, but marketed as Nissan.
Now, something else that people may want to have a bit of a look at is a website called dailyf1.com, and they've got about 30 photos inside the new Toyota Formula One factory, and it really is quite remarkable. They could build a space shuttle or perform open-heart surgery in this place. It really is an immaculate facility. So people may want to check that out and have a look inside Toyota Formula One.
Australian Formula 3 driver James Courtney, mentioning Jaguar earlier on, he was racing at Thruxton last weekend. In the first race, he finished fifth behind Anthony Davidson and Takuma Sato. Sato, by taking that win, brought himself even closer to the British Formula 3 Championship. In the second race, it was red flagged after Sato secured the championship, basically, by the fact that his teammate drove Courtney off the road in a rather dramatic move. And apparently, as a result, that one... Courtney finished up second in that race. In the championship overall, Sato's in the lead with Davidson second, Hayes third, and Courtney sitting in fourth. A couple of races to go, but unfortunately for him, I'd say with the way things are looking with Jaguar, he's possibly in a bad place.
Inside Motorsport is produced by Thunder Media in the studios of Triple S FM Canberra via Comrade Sat, with the support of the Community Broadcasting Association of Australia. Yeah.